This episode is brought to you by the 1-4 Group Incorporated, a leading supplier of innovative dormancy and sprout inhibiting products for the potato storage industry. They believe that sustainability is intrinsically linked with the concept of stewardship. 1-4 Group practices sustainability by helping farmers minimize product loss using their family of biocontrol products. Learn more at 1-4group.com.
Welcome to this episode of the Spudman Potato Field Podcast. Joining me today from St. Anthony, Idaho, is Britt Raybould of Raybould Brothers Farms. Britt is the immediate past president of the National Potato Council. She's still on the executive board. She just finished up her year extended, actually, as it turned out, as president, because they had to wait on swearing in the new president because of COVID delays and all that stuff. But Britt, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Zeke. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we definitely appreciate your time. We are still a few weeks away from planting, but I know everybody in the region is starting to gear up and get antsy, which you are as well. For starters, why don't we just start with a little background on Raybould Brothers Farms. How long have you guys been around, and what do you grow in the way of potatoes?
So Raybould Brothers Farms goes back to my grandfather and his brother, starting, you know, back in the 50s. We had a homestead place located in the Hibbard area just outside of Rexburg. And then there was some ground we rented up on what folks might know as the Rexburg Bench. And over time, we just expanded, with the biggest expansion happening after the Teton Dam broke in 1976. We came out into the Plano-Eugene area and purchased at the time, it was 10 fields. I don't believe we had any center pivots up at that point. I believe everything was still hand lines or wheel lines. And just from there, we have grown to just over 2,300 acres of both owned and rented ground. I currently work with my father, Jeff, my brother, Jaron, and then myself, and we grow russet Burbanks and russet Narcotas for the fresh and processed markets.
Okay. How has your role evolved? Once you came back to the farm from college, how has your role in the operation evolved?
So I started out as the person who was dealing with all of the tech issues. You know, back in the early 2000s, when we were looking at doing some of the different things around, you know, whether it was automation, or, you know, you were talking about having your GPS driven, you know, tractors, you know, things along those lines. I was kind of the default go-to person to help sort of figure out and navigate some of those things. Over time, that evolved into helping on the regulatory side, as we saw increased need to do things like the GAP program, the Good Agricultural Practices program through USDA. And of course, that's evolved over time. And now I have responsibility for, you know, completing our responsibilities related to the harmonized GAP program as it's evolved. And then over the last, what has it been, 3-4 years, I've just taken on more responsibility on the finance business side of things, and now hold officially the position, for whatever it's worth in terms of the title, of CFO. Mm-hmm. And so it's just been one of those things where I've stepped in where I've needed to on the business operations side. And then, of course, you know, I am always just a phone call away if somebody needs a body in a truck or in a tractor. You know, I'm someone who can step in and help with those different things. And, you know, then, of course, when it's harvest, it's all hands on deck, and everybody shows up and does their part. And so it's really worked out, I think, well, just from the standpoint of I have a really good working relationship with both my father and brother, and we have each other's backs. And I think it helps us do what we do individually better than we otherwise would if anyone was trying to do any of those things all by themselves.
And as far as getting back out in field, you know, it sounds like you're doing a lot of office work, you know, with the administration and the bookkeeping and all of that stuff. But when it is time for you to get out in field, and like you mentioned, all hands on deck, do you still savor getting the ability to do that?
You know, Zeke, the thing that's funny is I like doing it, but when I climb into a truck, I remember that I'm not 16 anymore. That truck is a little higher off the ground than it used to be. But, you know, otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that's a very, it's tangible, you know, for folks who find themselves in a position where, you know, the more of their work is taking them, you know, into the office, which I think is not uncommon in our industry as the demands have grown to take on some, you know, additional responsibilities. There is that benefit of being able to go out in the field and see this very tangible, very, very hands-on aspect of what it is that we do. And I think that's one of the reasons why our industry remains, I don't want to say down to earth in some sort of, backhanded compliment sort of way, but just in the sense of we understand the work that goes into this. And most of the folks I know who are running these operations, even if they're the heads of the organizations, they're also out in the fields doing the work. And I think it makes a difference that you're both in a position to understand the overall operation as the business owner, but at the same time, you're capable of going out into the field and doing the work as well. And I think that lends itself to the overall success that we see within our industry.
No, absolutely. You don't lose sight of every aspect of the operation. I would imagine that provides a lot of perspective. I mean, for everybody involved, when everybody kind of has to wear different hats throughout the year. Would you agree with that?
Oh, without question. I mean, during the winter months, for instance, within our operation, the bulk of what we do is taking equipment into our shop facilities and going through it for the next season. And at the same time that, that's happening, we're also making preparations for the next growing season in terms of forecasting what the market demand will be and how we're going to split up our acreage in terms of what particular variety we're going to do, where we're at in terms of rotation. And so you're wearing different hats at different parts during the year, but it's all interconnected. And at least in our case, we feel like we have a really good flow going in terms of who's focused on what and who's doing what. And at the end of the day, it's not unusual for, at least in our instance, my brother, my father, and myself to all end up together and just kind of go over where things are at and what's happened and what still needs to be done. And, in a few weeks, that probably won't be as possible as everybody's out in the field and is basically working from, the time you can see to the time you can't. And even in some instances after that, it's a different flow to things, but there's definitely a benefit, I think, to individuals who are able to move back and forth between sort of the operational and the hands-on piece, because it gives you a clearer sense of what's working and what's not.
And you mentioned that you grow a lot of Burbanks and Norcotas, which, I mean, that is absolutely the industry standards. Where are you guys at in terms of rotations? How often do you plant potatoes in fields? Are you on a 3-year or 4-year? And what are some of the rotational and crops that you're doing?
So in some of our heavier ground, we're able to do every other year, right? But that's limited to 4 pivots that we have still on the Rexburg bench. Most of the rest of the time we're doing 3-year rotations, and it just makes sense, both from an input standpoint and, from a sustainability and just land management standpoint to have a cycle that gets the best out of the property that you have, while at the same time not straining it to the point where you're then turning around and having to put in significant amounts of inputs to get it back up, to being a good piece of ground. In terms of rotation, we rotate with alfalfa and malt barley. Those are the two primary crops that we're going back and forth with in as part of our cycle.
Now, and you grew up in southeastern Idaho, which is probably the most productive potato producing region in North America. It might even be the world. What is the life like growing up on an Idaho potato farm? And what role does farming play in the community, in the culture there?
So as a kid growing up, you only know what you see. And what I saw was, potatoes. And so my assumption was that that's what everybody did, right? Of course, everyone was a potato farmer because that's what we did. And everyone around me, that's what we did. But over time, of course, we've seen consolidation, both within this area and the state and just within the industry as a whole. And so I think what it meant for me as a kid is perhaps different than what it means for someone who is growing up in a family that's involved in the potato industry now. As a kid, it was very much, you could run a farm with a family to an extent, right? I mean, we of course had, some full-time employees that helped out, but we had enough extended family, that could come in during harvest, and there were lots of cousins that would help and, things along those lines. And it really was sort of a family-centered operation. And I don't think I'm alone in saying that that has changed over the years, that you've had more family move away from the farming operations. It's become, in some respects, you know, potentially more limited, depending upon how many, you know, branches of the family are interested in farming or not. And I think, if nothing else, one of the key takeaways for me, just as part of that process of growing up on the farm, is I learned how to work. And, you know, I get that that's a little bit cliche, but, you know, when push came to shove and I was in a position, you know, be it in high school or in college or, you know, even just out of college, I felt like I had an edge over the folks who didn't grow up on a potato farm, because many of them didn't necessarily have that sort of foundational knowledge of, you know, what's required when you are living and working on a farm, what it takes to get jobs done. And so, you know, from that standpoint, I felt particularly lucky. And watching now, I see a lot of the same potential for, you know, my nieces are growing up and, you know, they're still a little, frankly, they're a little short to participate in the farming operation at this point, but, you know, they're very interested in it. They like coming with me, you know, during harvest when I can keep an eye on them and literally keep a hand on them so they don't, you know, get into too much trouble. But it's one of those things where there is the benefit of being able to pull other generations along. And, you know, I think there's a lot of value in that generational aspect of being able to provide that experience and that opportunity. And even if my nieces decide someday that this isn't the life for them, they want to move on and do something else, I think they'll still get a benefit from it. And I think that's true for anyone who's had the opportunity and the blessing to be a part of a potato farming family.
As far as yourself, did you always know you wanted to come back to the farm, or did you kind of take the long way around and eventually, I mean, did you entertain doing something else?
Well, when I was 18 and left to go to school, I swore I was never coming back. So you could say I had a little bit of a detour. And the large part of that was that, you know, when you're a teenager, you don't always appreciate how good you have it at the time. And I didn't fully grasp what it meant to live where I lived and to do what we do and to have that context. And so, you know, going away to school was a opportunity to be exposed to, you know, different things and frankly, even just sort of like different working environments and different living conditions and just getting sort of that up close of, you know, there are some other ways that people, you know, live, whether it be in an urban area or, you know, they're going into an office every day or whatever it may be. And coming to the realization after having those experiences for myself, that wasn't necessarily something that I wanted for the long term. And I had the reference point of being like, you know what, it maybe wasn't quite as bad as I thought it was at 18. And maybe, you know, there's something to that lifestyle, something to, you know, doing that kind of work. And so when, you know, the opportunity presented itself to come back and to be here and to be a part of things, I frankly jumped at the chance to do it, because I know that not everyone has the ability to come back, whether it's for, you know, financial reasons or family circumstances. And so I feel particularly blessed that there was that opening and that I was welcomed, back.
Do you struggle with black spot or pressure bruise in your potato crop? The proven BioControl 1-4 site helps increase deliverables to your shed or plant by reducing the severity and indices of bruise. Incorporate 1-4 site into your existing storage program for unprecedented success. Learn more at 1-4group.com. And now back to the podcast.
You have to spend several years on the executive committee of the NPC before you become president. So you've been very involved at this high level for a long time. How did that experience kind of formulate your goals of what you wanted to focus on as president? And second part of my question is, once you became president, it was like 2 months later, COVID hits, and how did that affect the whole experience and your term as NPC president?
So in terms of participation and, you know, whether it was myself or other members of my family, in these different organizations, what it comes down to is there is a lot that we can accomplish as an industry, but we can't do it if we're all in our own separate little corners, right? And so the primary value, whether they be the state organizations or a national operation like the National Potato Council, is the fact that it brings us together. And it brings us together, you know, regardless of where we may happen to be located, and does so in a way by, you know, finding opportunities to collaborate on issues that impact all of us. And because we're working together, we have that additional heft from a policy standpoint when it comes to, you know, pushing for specific legislation or dealing with regulatory issues. You know, we come to the table with, you know, with the weight of a full industry behind us, as opposed to any one of us as individuals. And, you know, so if I'm looking at the reasons to participate, it's one of those things of, I think about it a little bit like, you know, compounding interest. You put a little bit in, and as long as you continue to add to it over time, you're going to continue to get greater and greater benefits. So I look at what my grandfather contributed during his time, and it compounded into building off the foundation of what my father did during his time. And then, of course, you know, my participation, you know, as well, you know, when the time came for me to do it, gets to build off of what they've done. And so my hope is that the effort and the work that I did during, you know, my service at the MPC is going to be compounded in the future for other individuals in the industry as they continue to work on these issues. It's one of those things of where it's not any one person is getting the job done, but because we're working together as a whole, that we're able to accomplish so much. And that's one of the key takeaways that I have from watching both my grandfather and father over the years, is what they were able to do when they put in that effort and worked with others. And it made it possible for me to do, you know, what I did in partnership with other folks in the industry during my time. I did not anticipate in any way, shape, or form that my term would be disrupted by literally a global event. That's not something you can actually plan for. So I give a lot of credit to the MPC staff for their flexibility and how they just adapted to the situation and found ways to continue to do the engagement and the policy outreach that I think we have become well known for, both in Washington, D.C. and within the industry as a whole. And as a result, if I look back over, you know, that term, you know, I can't point to any specific numbers because I haven't done an analysis, but I think it was one of the most active policy advocacy periods of time that the MPC has had, and frankly, one of the most successful in terms of the benefits to the industry as a whole. And I give a lot of credit to Cam Quarles and to Mike Wenkel for the work that they did in Washington, D.C. Hillary and Holly and Mark Smansky, you know, our events and public relations folks, they literally figured out, if not overnight, pretty close to it, how to take sort of the public event side facing of what we do as an organization and make it accessible and doable online. And I think did so in a really beneficial way that sort of put a good foot forward in, you know, a less than ideal situation. And as a result, I think they discovered a lot of new tools and platforms that we'll be able to incorporate as part of our overall messaging and will just make us more successful as an organization going forward. And so as I look back over this last year, as crazy as it was, I'm really proud of where things, you know, went in terms of what the MPC demonstrated it was capable of doing. And at the same time, you know, the new things that, you know, MPC was able to pull off and was able to show that we really take seriously our position as a leader within the potato industry and are looking for ways to continue to, you know, be adaptable and to, you know, represent the industry to the best of our ability, no matter what challenges may come our way.
And just a little personal feedback, obviously with my position, you know, I'm keeping a keen eye on what the NPC is doing and trying to report on it to the industry. And I was very, very impressed with the ability of you all to, I know this term gets thrown a lot, pivot and change your priorities and communicate and decide what is necessary and where the industry needs to go in a very quick amount of time and get that done. So kudos to you and the staff there. On that note, if somebody maybe younger or has never been involved in things like the NPC or the IPC or other ag organizations came to you and said, you know, I'm not sure if I see the benefit. I'm, you know, it's not my nature to put myself out there. What advice might you have for them?
Come to a meeting. You know, the fact that you've come and that you're asking the question, that's the first step. And then the second step is to show up and see what you think. You know, one of my key sort of talking points over the last year was this notion of you don't have to be there 100% of the time to still provide a benefit to what we're doing. So if you can only be at our summer meeting, be at our summer meeting. If you can only come to the DC fly-in, come to the DC fly-in. It's the very act of sort of raising your hand and saying, hey, this is something that I think could be interesting or I think could be valuable, and showing up. You may discover that you have some hidden talents that you didn't realize before, and that you turn out to be really good at being an advocate for agricultural policy in Washington, D.C. Or you may discover that you've got a talent for going and doing things at the local level, you know, with your state legislators, right? It's the idea of be open to the possibility that an organization like this can provide benefit to you beyond sort of the obvious of, you know, like, let's say, for instance, the idea of, oh, will this increase how much I, you know, make for my crop, you know, as opposed to maybe the longer term perspective of, hey, this is an organization that may make it possible for me to be sustainable in a way that lets me transition this farm operation to the next generation, right? I mean, that's really what we're talking about in terms of, you know, the MPC is this, in some ways is this long-looking organization that's considering policies that are going to have impacts 5, 10, even 20 years down the road. And, you know, that can be a little daunting to contemplate. And yet at the same time, you know, your ability to get things done, I cannot overemphasize how important it is for you to just show up. Show up. Dip your toe in the water, you know, get a feel for it, but be there and be a part of things. I don't think you'll regret it.
And one thing that I actually have not mentioned yet was the fact that you served a term as a state representative in Idaho, which is, you know, a very unique experience and gives you a very unique perspective. And recently you posted on Twitter that you're starting a PhD program at Boise State on public policy and administration. So congratulations on pursuing that in that endeavor. So obviously you would like to stay involved into policymaking in some capacity. What are your short-term or long-term goals in that area? And what issues are you most passionate about?
You know, the thing that's so interesting to me about public policy is I think we treat it as sort of set in stone. We passed a law, we've set a regulation, okay, we're set, we're done, we move on. But the healthiest public policy, and the perspective that I'm coming to this from, is the idea that we know more today than we did 10 years ago, than we did 20 years ago, than we did 30 years ago. And in the future, we're going to know more than we did today. And so if we want to have smart public policy that actually leads to the sorts of benefits and, you know, more pro than con in terms of outcomes and the idea that we are working together from a community standpoint to collaborate on things that lead to, you know, circumstances that I think we're, you know, we're all looking for, right, is if we stay out in front and be proactive when it comes to public policy. Now, I understand how boring that sounds. I know there are a lot of people who think that's just a waste of time, or that's something that doesn't really matter, or it takes too long, or it's just all so political. And I get it, because I've seen both sides of it. I've been the person, you know, on the one side of the desk advocating for a particular policy, and I've been on the other side, you know, being advocated to, you know, to support a particular position. And so I see it. And the thing that I hope that over the course of my study, be it, you know, in the PhD program or, you know, in the future and in whatever role I may take, be it, you know, elected or some other position, is that I'm always open to the idea of learning how to do things better. And, you know, from that standpoint, right now, where I'm leaning is that my focus from a research perspective is going to be on water. You know, I don't think it's a secret how important water is, particularly out here in the West, but it's also important back East as well. You know, there are actually sections down in the South where you would think access to drinking water wouldn't necessarily be a huge issue. And yet given the amount of groundwater pumping that's gone on, you know, not only is the land sinking, which is lowering the levels along the coastlines and creating potential issues with salt water, coming in and contaminating water tables, but just the very fact that water is sort of that foundational thing that makes all of the other things possible, You want to have a healthy economy, you got to have a sustainable source of water. You want to have good schools, you know, I mean, it just, it's all interconnected together. And so I'm looking at this as a way to build out a framework that helps make some of those policymaking decisions even just a little bit easier, you know, because a lot of these decision-making processes happen over, you know, the span of years. For some folks who watch it, the Colorado Compact is coming up for renegotiation. It will expire in 2026. It's been in existence since 1922. And it's one of those things that people just have taken for granted. You know, for some people, that's the only water law that they have known for the entire extent of their lives. And now we're talking about going in and making revisions to, you know, this over, you know, almost 100-year-old compact. And 10% of U.S. residents are getting their drinking water from the Colorado River. So making changes to things like that, it's not a small thing. And so, you know, I'm optimistic that, you know, one, I both find, you know, research in and of itself interesting just because I like learning more. I like gaining a better understanding. And at the same time, figuring out how to take what I've learned and apply it in a meaningful way that makes a difference in people's lives. That's the long-term goal, is can I do something today that makes people better off than they were the day before? And if I have, then I consider that a win.
In terms of water, where do you see the biggest issues? Is it more of just an access standpoint, or where do you see the potential problems?
So quantity, I think, will always be an issue, particularly if we're talking about, you know, growing demand. I don't think it's a secret that a lot of the Western states are seeing, you know, significant influxes and increases in population. And by default, that's going to put additional pressures on the system. I think quality is really one of the biggest hurdles. You know, as we look at the idea of, well, do we have enough water? I think there's an argument to be made that we have enough water. It's more a question of, do we have enough water that's good enough? You know, in terms of, is it safe for drinking? Is it safe, for our communities? Are we not doing anything that essentially leaves us worse off than we were before in terms of how we're using water? And I think there's a lot of interesting discussions going on around that. You know, folks are quick to point fingers at agriculture as being a source of water contamination. I think agriculture can be a source of helping fix the problem personally, right? Because long term, it is to my benefit as a farmer to ensure that I have healthy ground and clean water, and that I am doing my part, you know, whenever possible, to ensure that those things remain in balance, not only for the purposes of my production, but also for the health of the community in which I live. And so I think that conversation over the next few years, there's going to be a balance between the idea of quantity and access, but also at the same time, the quality of the water that people have access to, and whether or not, you know, there are more steps that we can take to help, you know, address those issues. I think it's going to be that sort of push and pull between different groups.
Well, that's a great big picture perspective to think about that beyond just, you know, as in a farmer, just your own agriculture needs, but actually the access and quality of the masses, so to speak. So what else, with all your experience with the NPC, what are some of the other big issues that you think are going to be important for agriculture to tackle in the coming years?
You know, I think access to a stable workforce is going to make or break a lot of aspects of the industry. I know that there is the perspective that we can solve a lot of our workforce issues through robotics or automation. And I get it. I see the potential in a lot of the existing technology that we have. It doesn't change the fact that there still need to be bodies doing specific kinds of work. And that, given sort of the timing and the seasonality of the things that we do, there are some really specific requirements around that. I think that we as an industry need to be promoting the idea of having a workforce that we can depend on and that is reliable, because that in turn ensures that we can produce a reliable and affordable source of food whether it be for the US or for export to other countries. And I think for some folks, they get really focused on this idea of immigration as the notion of, oh, everybody wants to come here and stay here. And I just don't think that's the case, right? I think in terms of, this is my home, this is where I live. If I had to go somewhere else in order to secure, you know, work, in order to help cover, you know, the costs for my family, I would hate to think that I needed to take my entire family and uproot them from their life and from their world in order to accomplish that. If there's a way for individuals to come in and do the work on that seasonal basis and to know that they'll be able to do so, you know, safely, to receive fair pay and to be able to go back and forth without, you know, harassment at the border, I think you'd be shocked at the number of people who would happily go back and forth. And I think the assumption is that, oh, well, everyone wants to come over and then stay is part of what's getting in the way of fixing this idea around farm labor. You know, of course, it's a different situation if we're talking about, say dairies, for instance, where they have to have workers 365 days a year, right? That's a different kind of scenario. But for those of us in ag that are dealing with the idea of seasonal labor and, you know, having to have a surge during a particular period of time in order to, you know, get the crops in, manage it through the season, and then get the crops out, that's a really specific problem that I think we're in a position to address, but there are a lot of other issues that are getting in the way. And I think tied into that also is this question of access to markets, which is a trade issue. You know, if we're in a position where we're trying to ensure that the United States has fair and free access to different markets, I'm sure some folks have been watching what's been going on with the U.S. trying to get access into Mexico for potatoes. And we've been stymied over the years, you know, with domestic Mexican producers who have been very resistant to granting that access under existing trade deals. Of course, I am all for ensuring that we have fair access, you know, that's granted, you know, under the trade agreements that we've signed in good faith. But at the same time, we also need to be cognizant of the fact that we need to be playing fair with other countries as well, and ensuring that, you know, if we want to go into new markets, that we are providing the reciprocity that allows, you know, for all agricultural products to be able to have the back and forth. And in order to get those products to market, we need to have really good infrastructure. I don't think it's, let me put it this way. If you live in the northern part of the United States and you've had to drive on any roads that have been covered by snow or ice for the last 3 or 4 months, I'm guessing you've hit a pothole or two. And so we all know, you know, that there's that winter weather aspect of doing damage to our infrastructure. But just in general, if you look at the quality of our infrastructure, some of it is 50 or 60 years old. And we've done a little bit of maintenance along the way, but I look at that and say, if we don't make a significant investment in our infrastructure, then it won't matter how good a crop we produce if we can't then turn around and get it to market efficiently and reliably for our customers, because it won't matter, right? And for a lot of us, we're located in areas, you know, Idaho is just about as far away as you can be from some of the biggest markets in the country. We need a strong infrastructure in order to move our product from Idaho to those different urban areas. If I'm a Washington grower, I care about whether or not I can get my product on ships and get it out of ports and get it across the ocean over into Asian markets. It's all interconnected. And I think sometimes we treat things as either one-off issues or not related to each other, when in reality, if one thing doesn't work over here, finally enough, it doesn't take long for the other thing to not work over there either. And so the more we can look at this as sort of a cohesive, how can we chip away at some of these different things over time, I think the more progress we'll be able to make.
And on the subject of transportation, what do you guys do as far as shipping your product? Do you have a shipping operation as well, or a packing shed?
No, all of our shipments are handled through the packing sheds that, you know, that we deliver raw product to. They take care of, you know, all of, you know, sort of once it's left the field or left the storage facility, it's in someone else's hands to ensure that it reaches markets. But I have been on the receiving end of more than one phone call with the complaints about how difficult it was to secure trucks, to find space in trains, issues with, especially, movement during the pandemic, when it was really difficult for truck drivers to be moving product across the country. I think for some folks, I don't know that they realized how much that internal movement system of food would play a role. And, luckily all of the individuals involved sat down, worked together and found ways to help get things back up to speed. But right now, I don't know if anyone's watching it with as much interest as I am, but now there's a ship stuck in the Suez Canal sideways, and you have all of the shipping traffic that's now backed up behind it. And then you have other ships that are going down around South Africa to make the journey instead. And as a result, shipping costs have increased because a ship is stuck in a canal. And I don't know if there's a better way to capture sort of the logistics issues that we face in truly sort of a global world and some of the things that we have to be thinking about as an industry, right? It's the idea that this one thing, again, that's happening over here, in the Suez Canal can potentially have a ripple effect in the ability to move our product off of the West Coast and over to Asia. And so it's just having that level of awareness and understanding all of the interconnections and doing our best to navigate them that I think truly will benefit us as an industry as we continue to look for ways to adapt and to ensure that we can get to as many markets as possible.
And on that front, it just came out in your backyard, not too far away in Pocatello, they're starting construction on that intermodal railroad terminal that should help shipping out of that region. So hopefully that helps alleviate some of those things. But I mean, we all remember in this industry, about this time last year, might have been a little bit later, of hearing about potatoes being given away or buried because they didn't have a home. And, it makes the general consumer sick to see that food waste, and it makes all of us sick. But it was such an unavoidable thing because the supply chain is such a finely tuned mechanism that something like that just threw it off. So now we're in the business of doing things to prevent that kind of thing. So hopefully we get there. But one thing that you've mentioned to me before is that you're a voracious reader. Have you read any good titles lately?
Oh man, I've read quite a few actually. One of the ones I just finished was actually a biography about Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, and the role that she played during his career and during World War II. And I think the thing that I enjoyed so much about it was their partnership and how much, he was able to do because of the support that she provided to him and the work that she did separate from his that helped reinforce the things that he was doing. And funny enough, it's one of those things where I think there's, within our industry, there's a lot of working relationships like that, where, it may be the husband that's out in the field, doing, the specific work that's designated as his, and the wife is perhaps doing, another type of work, but the two together are that much stronger as a result of the work that they do. And it's one of those things where when you see partnerships like that, I think it's really useful to remember that it's difficult, I think, for anyone within our industry to accomplish much all by themselves, but that when we come together and work together, just how much, we're capable of doing.
Brett, you were incredibly insightful. I could listen to you talk for another an hour at least. So I really appreciate all of your insight and thoughtfulness, and I appreciate you coming on. And let's do it again down the line.
Happy to do it, Zeke. And I would just extend an invitation to anyone who's listening that if you have questions about the National Potato Council or participating in the industry, please don't hesitate to reach out. I'm more than happy to talk about it. And if you want, just a friendly face to see at the meetings, I would love to see more folks come to our events and to try it, even if it's your first time or you don't have any prior experience.
What's the best place for people to reach out? Should they go to Raybould Brothers website, Twitter? What's the best place to find you?
Hey, I'm just glad I've got all of my folks using the same email address. Websites would be a little bit of a stretch, but you can, frankly, why don't you send me a text message or give me a phone call? 208-419-0768. Happy to talk anytime. Like I said, I just want people to be there and to know that there's a place for them at the table.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Britt. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Zeke.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And thanks again to One4Group, our sponsor. Be sure to go check them out at one4group.com. We'll see you next time.